Does living alone mean something different now that we're hyper-connected through cell phones, social media, and the like? Has the fast growth of living alone among young adults led them to prioritize their personal development and avoid participating in communities and groups? Or has it paved the way for new urban tribes to replace the traditional families that, as so many of us know from experience, often break apart? Do the social networks formed by contemporary solo dwellers survive when participants marry, move, grow old, or become ill? If not, what happens to those who stay on their own? Some questions are political. Will the growing ranks of people who live alone develop a collective identity and, as some prominent strategists believe, establish themselves as a lobbying group or voting bloc? Or will solo living give rise to political atomization, with each person promoting his or her own interests or looking out for his or her own needs? Will the nations where aging alone has become rampant invest in social programs that help those who become isolated, frail, and sick? What fate awaits us if we don't? For many of us, the mere thought of living alone sparks anxieties about isolation, and not without reason. But although it's clear that for certain people in certain conditions, living alone can lead to loneliness, unhappiness, sickness, or worse, it's also clear that it need not have such disastrous effects. Today, more and more people are seeking ways to flourish despite, or is it because of, the solitude they can achieve at home? Young professionals who can afford to have their own places and prefer domestic autonomy to having roommates. Singles in their 30s and 40s who refuse to compromise in their search for a partner, in no small part because they recognize and enjoy the benefits, personal, social, and sexual, of living alone. Divorced men and women whose previous experiences in relationships ended the fantasy that romantic love is a reliable source of happiness and stability. Elderly people who, following the death of a spouse, rebuild their lives through new friendships, social groups, and activities, and take pride in their ability to live alone. Though each of these situations is distinctive, those who confront them share a common challenge. They must not only solve the puzzle of how to live alone, but also of how to live well. In this, they are in good company, and all of us, no matter where we are or whether we live with someone at this moment, can learn from their answers. 1. Going solo. On September 30, 2007, the Non-Committals won the championship of the Brooklyn Kickball Invitational Tournament, defeating Prison under the lights of Greenpoint's McCarran Park. The teams were comprised mostly of young middle-class adults in their 20s and 30s who played regularly in a local league, but competitors came from as far as Providence, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, and Toronto. Today, there are booming kickball clubs in Maui, Miami, Dallas, Denver, San Diego, and Seattle. The World Adult Kickball Association, which hosted 72 teams and 1,500 players at its 2009 Founders Cup in Las Vegas, calls the game the new American pastime. That's clearly a misnomer, however, since the group has also helped organize leagues in England and India and is eagerly seeking additional outposts. It's hard not to interpret the surprising popularity of this childhood game as a symbol of the historically new life stage that sociologists call second adolescence. This period of prolonged development on the path to adulthood is growing increasingly common in affluent nations, where young adults are growing ever more committed to non-committal living, as the Brooklyn champs would put it. In Chicago, for instance, one organization's ads for a kickball league claim, "Recess was never this much fun." And its campaign for a dodgeball league, what else, promises, "As an adult, you can relive the glory days on the playground." In some places, games reproduce the college fraternity experience as well as elementary school days. During slosh ball competitions, ESPN reports, players must hold a beer at all times, and runners cannot advance until they shotgun a beer. In New York City, games are played in the epicenter of Brooklyn hipster culture, and instead of engaging in frat house behavior, participants act like natives going straight from the ball field to the barroom, where they'll listen to indie rock bands till early the next day. At season's end, they gather in Greenpoint for the kickball prom. Playing children's games on weekends is not the only way that today's young adults revisit adolescence. They stay in school longer than did previous generations, knowing that the job market rewards them for being both well-trained and flexible, and guessing that it's unwise to commit too hastily to a career path or to a corporation that will not commit to them. They delay marriage and having children, and spend years engaged in casual sex or serial dating, often remaining skeptical that an intimate relationship can last a lifetime. They chat on instant message and social network sites, play video games, share music online. Those younger than 25 even move back in with their families, frequently enough to be labeled the boomerang generation by journalists and sociologists. But viewed historically, the boomerang label is undeserved, as is the view that by indulging in a second adolescence, young adults are neglecting to grow up. It is widely believed that young adults are more likely to live with their parents now than ever before, writes sociologist Michael Rosenfeld. But, in fact, he notes, compared to previous generations, they are far more likely to establish themselves in a home of their own. While it's true that the prevalence of people ages 25 to 34 living with their parents has gone up since 1960, the increase has been modest, from 11% to 14% for men and from 7% to 8% for women. The more significant change in the culture of young adults involves breaking away from their family home. Consider, for instance, that only 1% of people ages 18 to 29 lived alone in 1950, while 7% do today, or that 11% of people ages 20 to 29 lived apart from their parents back then, whereas today more than 40% do. Not all of them live alone, but leaving home is a necessary condition for doing so. The increase in this type of living arrangement has grown astonishingly since 1970, observed demographers Elizabeth Fussell and Frank Furstenberg, Jr., marking a new sort of independence from family with significant social meaning. This is an understatement. In recent decades, a growing number of 20 and 30-somethings have come to view living alone as a key part of the transition to adulthood. In the large urban areas where it is most common, many young professionals see having one's own home as a mark of distinction and view living with roommates or parents as undesirable at best. Living alone offers several advantages. It grants sexual freedom and facilitates experimentation. It gives time to mature, develop, and search for true romantic love. It liberates young adults from difficult roommates, including good friends who turn out to be better friends when they are not always in the next room. It enables them to socialize when and how they want to, and to focus on themselves as much as they need. Why did the practice of living alone grow so popular among young adults, and how did it turn from a sign of social failure to a rite of passage and a reward for success? To answer these questions, we need to look more closely at how the public life of cities, and more specifically, the subculture of singles, encouraged new forms of individualism. For the urban bohemians who first experimented with solo living in neighborhoods like Greenwich Village did something that they hadn't intended. They pioneered a lifestyle whose broad appeal would ultimately bring it into the mainstream. We also need to examine the private lives of families, because changes in the way we relate to one another inside the home have led more of us to grow comfortable in a place of our own. First, though, we should step back to see what we might call the old cult of the individual, if only to establish how different it is from the individualism we find in cities today. The contemporary view of living alone as a productive experience grew out of a rich historical legacy. The monastic tradition, which has roots in ancient China, Egypt, and Syria, valorized asceticism as a path to knowledge and a meaningful life. According to monastic teachings, separating from society is the most powerful way to get closer to the divine. This is why the 4th century hermit Abba Moses issued his famous instruction, "Go sit in your cell, and your cell will teach you everything." In practice, however, few hermits were true solitaries. Whether in the desert or on the outskirts of a town, they typically lived in settlements shared by other men and congregated with them for a variety of purposes. The historian Peter Brown writes that in Egypt, where the theory and practice of ascetic life reached its highest pitch of articulateness and sophistication, groups had to reproduce exactly, on the fringe of the desert, the closed-in, embattled aspect of the fortified villages. He notes further that the monastery of Pachomius was called quite simply the village. In ancient China, writes the Asia scholar A'at Vervorn, the earliest versions of Eremitism were secular and philosophical rather than religious, and the lifestyle involved not renouncing society so much as a lack of regard for those things of the world that are common objects of human action, such as wealth, power, and fame. Over the centuries, these traditions have evolved and mutated as much as they have traveled. Today, we find traces of the old cult of the individual in romantic ideals that emphasize solitude as a return to nature, in the spirit of Thoreau or John Muir, as a path to the sacred, as for Thomas Merton or Hesse's Siddhartha, or, as the psychologist Anthony Storr put it, as a return to the creative self. These are all influential perspectives, and they no doubt fed the stream of ideas that gave rise to the belief that living alone is important for becoming an autonomous adult. But they also share a decidedly anti-urban and anti-social bias, and are, in many ways, antithetical to the practice of living alone in the city. To find the sources of our contemporary ways of settling down, we must look beyond the traditions of the monastery and toward those of the modern metropolis. The metropolis, wrote the German sociologist Georg Simmel, assures the individual of a type and degree of personal freedom to which there is no analogy in other circumstances. Simmel was born in Berlin in 1858, when the population was about 460,000, and during his lifetime he witnessed it grow to more than 2 million people. Many of his contemporaries, particularly those who participated in the Romanticist movement against modernity, lamented the moral and cultural changes wrought by urbanization. But Simmel doubted that the less urban life was more virtuous and meaningful. He rebuked those like Nietzsche and Ruskin who believed that cities crushed the individual spirit. Small-town life, he argued, imposed such limits upon the movements of the individual in his relationships with the outside world and on his inner independence and differentiation that the modern person could not even breathe under such conditions. The city, by contrast, offered possibilities for social evolution, because in it, the individual's horizon is enlarged, and he gains a freedom of movement beyond the first jealous delimitation of the family or the religious community. In the city, the individual could participate in any of the emerging social groups or subcultures that matched his preferences and interests. What evolved from this new social landscape, Simmel claimed, was a new metropolitan type of individual, with a rational and intellectual orientation to the world, a deep psychological life, and a cool blasé attitude that he designated as reserve. City dwellers were hardly inhibited. On the contrary, Simmel insisted that modern urban culture liberated residents and allowed them to cultivate the very parts of themselves that the village had repressed. Individual freedom, he wrote, is not only to be understood in the negative sense as mere freedom of movement and emancipation from prejudices and Philistinism. Its essential characteristic is rather to be found in the fact that the particularity and incomparability which ultimately every person possesses is actually expressed, giving form to life. We follow the laws of our inner nature, and this is what freedom is. For city dwellers at the turn of the 20th century, being liberated from the tight grip of the family, the constraints of religious traditions, and the surveilling eyes of a small-town community was exhilarating. It's often argued that modern urban culture helped usher in an era of great creativity and aesthetic experimentation, giving rise to avant-garde movements such as Surrealism, Dadaism, and the Bauhaus. But modern cities induced extraordinary innovations in what Simmel called the everyday techniques of living, too, because they rewarded residents who gave up old habits and acculturated to the new social scene. While the aesthetes declared that they were treating art as life, even the less eccentric urbanites began to experience life as art, remaking themselves, their communities, and their homes to suit their inner natures, pushing back against the concrete institutions that the city and the state were already rebuilding. From today's perspective, the act of taking a place of one's own does not appear especially peculiar or extreme, to use Simmel's terms. But at the turn of the century, it was a bold and provocative way to use one's social liberties. Not that young single adults were uncommon in the late 19th century, when young workers were abandoning their native towns to seek jobs in metropolitan areas. In 1890, the proportion of young single men, ages 15 to 34, living in large American cities was higher than it would be until about 1990. And at the time, the average age of first marriage was also higher than it would be for another century, roughly 26 for American men and 22 for American women. The fact that these are averages means that many delayed marriage until they were even older. In 1900, fully one-third of all native-born American white men between the ages of 25 and 34 were single, as were half of all native white men that age in New York City. Hardly any of these bachelors lived alone, however. About half of all unmarried men and a greater proportion of unmarried women lived with their family, just as they do in parts of Southern Europe and in many developing nations today. Nearly all of those who left their family home to work in a distant neighborhood or city rented a room from another family, or, to the growing dismay of social workers and sociologists, moved into a rooming house. Rooming houses, which were known as plain hotels for plain people, were precursors to the small private apartments that would ultimately house single urban residents. They were popular among people in skilled trades who made a steady but modest income and wanted to escape surveillance, but their abundance and accessibility made them attractive for many migrants to the city. Hotel life, writes the architectural historian Paul Groth, could be virtually untouched by the social contract and tacit supervision of life found in a family house or apartment unit shared with a group. This fact aroused great anxiety among moral reformers of all stripes, who feared that living outside a family home would lead to isolation and a host of social problems. Solo living was said to be dangerous for men because it made them selfish and vulnerable to wanton impulses, and for women because it made them lonely, hysterical, and depressed. As early as 1856, the poet Walt Whitman authored Wicked Architecture, an essay in which he listed the personal consequences of boarding house life as listlessness, emptiness, sloth, nerves, dyspepsia, flirtations, prodigality, vain show, perhaps, often, might we not say, immorality, nay, infamy. 50 years later, a well-known Protestant minister warned that the rooming house system was stretching out its arms like an octopus to catch the unwary soul. And in his classic 1929 field study, The Gold Coast and the Slum, University of Chicago sociologist Harvey Zorba lamented that the typical rooming house has no dining room, no parlor, no common meeting place. Few acquaintanceships spring up in a rooming house. The keeper of the rooming house has no personal contact with or interest in his roomers. Along with many of his contemporaries in the social sciences, Zorba argued that living without a domestic partner was one of the key urban conditions that generated personal disorganization and social anomy. To illustrate the point, he offered statistics that showed a concentration of suicides in the neighborhoods where boarding houses were common, as well as a series of horrific stories from the world of furnished rooms. In the story of a charity girl, a young woman from Emporia, Kansas, moves into a rooming house when she arrives in Chicago at age 22 to attend music school. She reports that it is impossible to make friends there, and within a few months of her arrival, "my loneliness amounted almost to desperation." The charity girl endures a series of horrors. Her mother dies. Her father won't talk to her because she has moved to the city. Her music teacher blithely tells her she's not good enough to really make it, and she has no one to comfort her, not even the other souls who share her home. "I began to look at my life in Chicago. What was there in it, after all? My music was gone. I had neither family nor friends." For Zorba, this was a parable about the dangers of urbanization. "The city is like that," he quoted her as saying, and added his own conclusion. "Such complete anonymity could be found nowhere but in the city of today, and nowhere in the city save in the rooming house." Some city dwellers relished this anonymity, however, because it liberated them to live by their own inner laws. In another classic study from the University of Chicago, The Ghetto, sociologist Lewis Wirth explained that in the early 20th century, a number of Jewish hotels popped up in Chicago to house Jews who wanted to escape the confines of their local community. During the same era in New York City, writes one historian, the first full-blown generation of American moderns moved to Greenwich Village so they could enjoy life without a father, to use Gertrude Stein's phrase, and forge a community of dissidents who prided themselves on living a life apart. Villagers took up a great variety of personal, political, and aesthetic causes. But as Ross Whetstone argued in his neighborhood history, Republic of Dreams, they were motivated by one common aspiration, the liberated self. The village of the early 20th century was famous for its intellectuals, artists, activists, and eccentrics, including celebrated figures such as Georgia O'Keeffe, Emma Goldman, Eugene O'Neill, Alfred Stieglitz, Walter Lippmann, Claude McKay, and Eleanor Roosevelt. But even the more ordinary villagers enjoyed the freedoms available in what the historian Christine Stansell calls the cradle of liberated persona, a place where cloistered identities can come out of their hiding places, and all variety of individuals could foster more fully realized selves. Women's ability to find work in the paid labor market was a key part of this self-actualization because it gave them a degree of financial autonomy as well as a way to break out of the domestic sphere. The community, Stansell continues, nurtured a population of single women supporting themselves outside traditional family situations. Ladies went to work by themselves every day. They rode streetcars alone. And their discussions focused on how women might live outside traditional domestic roles. Whether in New York, Chicago, London, or Paris, experiments like these spawned a new storyline in the day's novels. The pleasures and dangers of being alone in the city excited the imagination of female contemporaries, writes Judith Walkowitz. Heroines, adds Stansell, lit by the high ambitions of their generation, set out to prove themselves in the world, rejecting romantic love, determined to find new stories for themselves beyond marriage. The bohemian culture of the village was not entirely due to the spirit of its residents. The neighborhood's spatial arrangements, its narrow, windy streets, its intimate cafes, salons, and saloons, its great central gathering place, Washington Square Park, provided both privacy for personal experimentation and a zone for self-expression and public display. At the beginning of the 20th century, the area had a great number of tenement buildings that warehoused large families. But over the next few decades, builders developed an ample supply of small, relatively inexpensive residential units in rooming houses and apartment buildings, which enabled the modern men and women of the place where everything happens first to live alone. In 1917, the year that Marcel Duchamp and friends ascended the Washington Square Arch and declared the area a free and independent republic, the writer Anna Alice Chapin identified a building nearby as the first all-bachelor apartment house erected in town. It is appropriately called the Benedick, from Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing, after a certain young man who scoffed at matrimony. By the 1920s, developers were converting single-family houses and tenements into one- or two-room apartments, and women as well as men rushed to fill them. The sources of this demand are not hard to identify. Between 1920 and 1930, the population of children under age 14 in the village dropped by around 50%. By 1930, about half of the adult men in the village were unmarried, as were 40% of all women. These changes were consistent with the general population trends for New York City, but they happened faster in the village and in more exaggerated fashion. In a decade, the community of families had turned into an urban enclave for adults, particularly for singles. A growing vanguard lived alone, and the rest of the city would soon follow its lead. Like the Bohemians, gay men at the turn of the 20th century also moved to cities and sought housing that would free them from supervision and social control. The historian George Chauncey has documented how gay friends in New York City helped each other identify places where landlords and neighbors were tolerant, recruiting other gay men for adjoining units, lest someone more judgmental and intrusive move in. Rooming houses were especially attractive, not only because they maintained a culture of privacy, but also because they allowed residents to pay by the day or week, which made them easy to abandon if something went wrong. Chauncey reports that certain hotel residences in Manhattan attracted large numbers of gay men, as did the apartment houses where, as one analyst put it, your neighbor is just a number on the door. Entire neighborhoods in Greenwich Village, Chelsea, Hell's Kitchen, the East 50s and 60s, became gay enclaves, organized around bars, cafeterias, cheap restaurants, literary societies, and community centers that helped men support each other in the quest to define themselves. By the 1920s, these areas had established reputations as places where people of all sexual persuasions could come together to enjoy their autonomy without worrying too much about whether anyone else was watching. In fact, before long, people went to New York City's bohemian, bachelor, and gay neighborhoods precisely so that they could watch, if not participate in, their distinctive subcultural scenes. It is well known that during the Harlem Renaissance, middle-class whites traveled uptown for a taste of the neighborhood's exotic jazz clubs and intoxicating nightlife. So, too, did they go downtown to sample the village's bohemian offerings. The village attracted visitors at all hours, but at night, its busy streets and buzzing cultural institutions transformed the area into a theater of the new, modern lifestyle, and an adventuresome audience from the city and beyond flocked to the site. This is precisely what happens when a city's public life is robust. Strangers meet in a densely packed, diverse social environment. The stage and street merge. A new public geography develops. And then, as Richard Sennett argues in The Fall of Public Man, the imaginative limits of a person's consciousness are expanded because the imagination of what is real and therefore believable is not tied down to a verification of what is routinely felt by the self. The idea that one could live quite socially while keeping a place of one's own shifts from being strange and unimaginable to being tantalizing and concrete. Just as white middle-class exposure to African-American music, dance, art, and literature during the Harlem Renaissance began to nudge blacks from the margins to the mainstream of U.S. popular culture, so too did the middle-class engagement with the world of bachelors and bohemians plant the seeds for the slow growth of new ideals about how to live. This is not to say that great numbers of Americans, or even New Yorkers, suddenly abandoned their aspirations to settle down in a traditional relationship. In fact, between the 1920s and the 1950s, the dominant practice among young adults involved making a quick and early start to domestic life, and the average age of first marriage dropped by about 2 years for men, from 24.6 to 22.8, and 1 year for women, from 21.2 to 20.3. But during those same decades, an alternative lifestyle, modern, independent, and single, was sprouting up in cities like New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle. New women, as the most liberated called themselves, were at the forefront of the change. The single woman, far from being a creature to be pitied and patronized, is emerging as the newest glamour girl of our times. She is engaging because she lives by her wits. She supports herself. She has had to sharpen her personality and mental resources to a glitter in order to survive in a competitive world, and the sharpening looks good. Economically, she is a dream. She is not a parasite, a dependent, a scrounger, a sponger, or a bum. She is a giver, not a taker, a winner, and not a loser. In 1962, a 40-year-old named Helen Gurley Brown published these words in her slim, sensational bestseller, Sex and the Single Girl. Brown, who went on to edit Cosmopolitan for more than 3 decades, had humble origins. She spent her early childhood in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas, but moved to Los Angeles at age 10 after her father died. She was raised by her mother. Her family was poor and her sister had polio. Brown, who supported them, developed a first-hand appreciation for the struggles and aspirations of working women in her generation. She attended a small business college, found clerical work in a talent agency, and shifted into advertising when she was hired as a secretary. She gradually moved up the ranks, becoming one of the industry's most accomplished copywriters before branching out into journalism. Sex and the Single Girl, which came out a year before Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, was the kind of feminist tract that scandalized and alienated a great many feminists. For it was written not against what Friedan famously called the problem with no name, inequality of the sexes generated through discrimination at home, in the courts, in politics, and in the workforce, but for women who felt oppressed by the overwhelming social pressure to settle down early, foregoing years of experimentation, growth, and pleasure to get a marriage license for a domestic life that they might not need or want. Brown insisted that young women should enjoy their best years without a husband. A single woman's biggest problem is coping with the people who are trying to marry her off, she argued, while marriage should be insurance for the worst years of your life. Brown's book was not a study on how to get married, but how to stay single in superlative style. She offered her own life as Exhibit A. Sex and the Single Girl opens with Brown's account of how, by delaying marriage until age 37, she wound up with a smart and sexy husband who worked in the movie business, two Mercedes in the driveway, and a big house overlooking the Pacific Ocean. It was not easy to maintain her autonomy, Brown admitted. During her 20s and early 30s, she watched her contemporaries rush into wedlock, often settling for men whose flaws were readily apparent. Although many's the time I was sure I would die alone in my spinster's bed, I could never bring myself to marry just to get married. Instead, she worked doggedly to advance in her career. She developed a fierce aggression and a unique style that she was willing to get out in the open. None of this, according to Brown, required great beauty, wealth, or a high-voltage personality. It simply demanded guts, conviction, and the fortitude to live alone. Brown did mean alone. Roommates, she insisted, are for sorority girls. You need an apartment alone, even if it's over a garage. The benefits of going solo were innumerable. With a home of one's own, a single woman could have time and space to cultivate herself without the social pressure of family or friends. She could work late without worrying anyone, furnish her mind through reading, change her appearance as she saw fit. Most of all, she gained privacy, and with that, the freedom to experience a more adventurous, libidinous life. The single girl has a better sex life than most of her married friends, Brown claimed, albeit without providing any evidence. She need never be bored with one man per lifetime. Her choice of partners is endless, and they seek her. The private apartment, writes the literature scholar Sharon Marcus, became a powerful symbol of the new urban culture during the 1960s because it offered the single girl an eroticized arena in which to exercise her creativity and promote her own creative comforts. But few single women expected to maintain this arena for long. Brown, after all, proposed living alone not as a means to subverting marriage, but rather as a means to improving it. Serving time as a single woman, she counseled, can give you the foundation for a better marriage if you finally go that route. It could also prepare a modern woman for the possibility that, even if she married, she would one day find herself on her own again, since a man can leave a woman at 50, though it may cost him some dough, as surely as you can leave dishes in the sink. Indeed, when Brown wrote Sex and the Single Girl, a nascent cultural movement was pushing men to do precisely this, promoting a new bachelor lifestyle that repudiated marriage and family altogether. The movement had an outlet in Playboy magazine, an iconic leader in Hugh Hefner, its publisher and editor, and a totem in the bunny ears that signaled men's endorsement of a new way of living. I don't want my editors marrying anyone and getting a lot of foolish notions in their heads about togetherness, home, family, and all that jazz, said Hefner. His magazine did everything possible to discourage readers from getting those notions, too. Playboy condemned conventional domestic life, but embraced a new kind of masculine domesticity. Throughout the 1950s and 1960s, writes Bill Osgerby in The Journal of Design History, Playboy spotlighted a series of luxurious Playboy pads, both actual buildings and fantasy blueprints, tailored to the outlook and tastes of the hip man about town. In The Hearts of Men, Barbara Ehrenreich argues that the magazine's ideological project involved reclaiming the indoors as a realm for masculine pleasure. It's not so subtle message to readers, abandon all ye who open these pages, your suburban home, your station wagon, your controlling wife. Return to the great city. Get a place of your own and fill it with modern luxuries, fine liquor, modern art, hip clothing, a stereo, leather furniture, a king-size bed, and the greatest pleasure of all, beautiful, available women. Playboy loved women, Aaron Reich writes, large-breasted, long-legged young women anyway, and it hated wives. Marilyn Monroe graced the cover of its first issue, which also included an attack on alimony and a story about Miss Gold Digger of 1953. Hundreds, eventually thousands of women posed nude for its centerfold spreads and photo features. Producers of high-end men's products bought ad space so that their brands would be associated with the lifestyle Hefner advocated. Real women were welcome in a Playboy's private home, particularly if they were the fun-loving, nubile, liberated kind that the magazine celebrated. Hefner surrounded himself with bunnies, first in a Chicago apartment and eventually in the famous Los Angeles mansion, and he took on several lovers at a time. His policy was always straightforward. Women could visit, spend a night, or many more. But they shouldn't get too comfortable, seek emotional commitment, or expect him to settle down. His bed may have been open, but in the end, it was his alone. Not that he had to make it. By the 1970s, both sexes benefited from the dramatic expansion of the service economy, including home cleaning, child care, elder care, food delivery, even laundry. Drawing on data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the sociologist Susan Thistle has shown that, since the 1970s, the conversion of women's domestic tasks into work done for pay has been the area of greatest job growth. There's a simple reason for this. Record numbers of women have been moving into the paid labor market. In 1950, about one in three of all adult women participated in the civilian labor market. By 1980, more than one half did. Women with more education entered the workplace at an even faster rate. Employment for those who had completed some college went from 51% to 67% during the 1970s, and from 61% to 74% among those who had earned a college degree. As these women left their invisible jobs as uncompensated domestic workers, they generated new demand for other people, mainly women, who could replace them. The personal services industry has grown ever since. Although women's wages lagged behind men's, and still do, their rapid entry into the paid labor market made it far easier for them to achieve independence than ever before. The average age of first marriage, which rose slowly during the 1960s, jumped considerably in the 1970s, from 21 to 22 for women, and from 23 to 25 for men. Adults didn't only delay marriage during the tumultuous decade, they also terminated it at unprecedented rates. In 1970, about 700,000 American couples divorced, a high figure compared to the 393,000 divorces in 1960 and the 385,000 in 1950. But 1980 was unprecedented, with roughly 1.2 million divorces. Demographers calculated that the divorce rate had jumped 50% during the 1970s, and they marveled at the startling fact that 25% of all marriages that took place in 1970 had been terminated by 1977. The nation had experienced a divorce revolution, and the transformation wasn't due solely to women's increased participation in the labor market. It was also fueled by an emerging moral code that placed one's obligation to care for the self on par with, if not above, one's commitment to family. Beginning in the 1950s, argues Barbara Defoe Whitehead in The Divorce Culture, Americans became more acutely conscious of their responsibility to attend to their own individual needs and interests, People began to judge the strength and health of family bonds according to their capacity to promote individual fulfillment and personal growth, rather than on more traditional measures such as income, security, or class mobility. Scholars in Europe identified a similar shift. The British sociologist Anthony Giddens argues that once women achieved economic independence, couples began to seek pure relationships, which are free-floating and not anchored in traditional financial or social constraints. The modern marriage, he writes, becomes more and more a relationship initiated for and kept going for as long as it delivers emotional satisfaction to be derived from close contact with another. When it fails to do so, as marriage often does during hard times, individuals feel an obligation to justify sustaining it because divorce is a readily available option. By the 1970s, more people began to act as if their quest for personal happiness, whether as a playboy, a liberated woman, or simply a single, trumped all other obligations. During that decade, writes David Sarasson, the freedom to hop from one relationship to the next was as essential as anything in the Bill of Rights. Finding a place of one's own was the best way to achieve it. During the 1960s and 70s, the housing market aided the search for autonomy, with inventory expanding much faster than the population, particularly in central cities, where middle-class families were fleeing. The urban crisis, as it came to be known, proved itself an opportunity for unmarried adults seeking their own apartments in metropolitan settings. In most big cities, middle-class individuals could easily find affordable rental units, and as they clustered together in places of their own, they forged neighborhood cultures organized around single life. Lincoln Park in Chicago, the Marina District in San Francisco, West Hollywood in Los Angeles, Belltown in Seattle. These weren't bohemias or gay enclaves, but places for urban professionals, the young and never married, as well as divorcees. They were full of apartment buildings, both new and newly renovated, to meet the needs of an increasingly individuated marketplace. Solo living was suddenly in vogue. Consider how many people were doing it. In 1960, about 7 million Americans lived alone, but by the end of the decade, more than 4 million others had joined them, making for some 11 million one-person households in the United States. During the 1970s, the ranks rose faster and higher than ever before, topping 18 million in 1980. The increase was particularly sharp in cities. In Manhattan, for instance, the proportion of residential units with just one resident went from 35% in 1960 to 46% in 1980, and the proportional rise was even greater in Los Angeles, Chicago, Dallas, Seattle, and San Francisco. The numbers of people living alone has continued to increase since the 1970s. It rose slowly during the 1980s and 1990s, then soared in the 2000s. Today, more than 5 million Americans under 35 have places of their own. Many of the young adults who live alone were brought up to do so. Not explicitly, since all children share their home with a family or adults of some sort, and schools do not promote living alone as a goal. But today, an unprecedented number of children around the world develop the capacity and desire to live independently through another historically novel experience, growing up in a room of one's own. Traditionally, most children in the same family shared a room with each other, if not with their parents. This was true, of course, for the children of immigrant families who lived in urban tenements, and of African-American children whose families packed into apartments after migration to the northern states. But until recently, it was also true of native-born white middle-class families, and even of some affluent ones. According to the U.S. Census, in 1960, the average family household had 2.4 children and 0.7 bedrooms per child. Since then, American families have become smaller and homes have grown larger. By 1980, the average household had 2 children and 1 bedroom per child, and in 2000, it had 1.9 children and 1.1 bedrooms per child, meaning it is common for American kids to have not only their own room, but perhaps even some claim on another one. Indeed, the size of a typical American home more than doubled between 1950 and 2000, rising from 983 square feet to more than 2,200. Today, in many middle-class communities, parents feel negligent if they don't provide a private bedroom for each of their children. Adults who love living in city centers will leave for the suburbs so they can give their children private space. Once a luxury, in recent years it has become an entitlement of middle-class life. Whether in cities or suburbs, today's children also spend an unprecedented amount of time home alone, preparing their own snacks or meals and planning their own leisure time, because it's increasingly common for both of their parents to spend their weekdays at work. According to Latchkey Kids, a report by the William Gladden Foundation, by 2005, somewhere between 10 million and 15 million American children under age 16 were regularly taking care of themselves after school or during summer vacations. More children today have less adult supervision than ever before in American history, the report claims, and many begin their self-care at about age 8. The rise of latchkey kids and private rooms within the home is an international phenomenon. In Europe, the dramatic decline in fertility rates over the past 50 years has transformed the experience of domestic space. Between 1960 and 2000, the average number of people per household fell from 3.1 to 2.3 in England, from 3.1 to 2.4 in France, from 3.8 to 2.6 in Germany, from 3.6 to 2.6 in Italy, and from 2.8 to 2.1 in Denmark. The trends are similar in Canada, where between 1960 and 2005, the average household size dropped from 4 to 2.5. In Japan, where from 1975 to 2005, it went from 3.3 to 2.5. And in the United States, where it plummeted from nearly 5 in 1900 to 3 in 1950 and 2.6 in 2000. In nearly all of these nations, the shrinking family has coincided with the extraordinary physical growth of the house and the apartment. By the late 20th century, people throughout the developed world could be together at home with their family, but also alone. Today, of course, we no longer need private rooms to separate into individual environments. Entire families can sit together and even share a meal while each member is immersed in an iPhone or a laptop rather than in conversation with those nearby. But the availability of a domestic private sphere for each person in a middle-class residence changed the norms of family interaction long before the advent of social media. In her comparative study of child-rearing practices among different class groups in the United States, sociologist Annette LaRoe noticed that in the typical middle-class family, each child has his or her own room and, except for times when they share meals, this happens only once every few days, parents and children are rarely all together in the same room. Instead, family life is organized around the needs and interests of each individual, parents and children included. The children do not belong to the same sports teams, play the same instruments, or hang out with the same friends, so the family develops a schedule that allows each one to be dropped off and picked up on his or her own. The parents do everything to promote the individual development of each child, and in the process, the children learn to think of themselves as special and as entitled. But they also grow hostile toward and competitive with their siblings. For although the middle-class children rarely engage in face-to-face interaction with each other, Leroux observes, references to hating a family member are common and elicit no special reaction. Things are calmer when everyone keeps to himself. In an influential 1958 essay, the psychologist and pediatrician Donald Winnicott argued, paradoxically, that the capacity to be alone is based on the experience of being alone in the presence of someone, and that without a sufficiency of this experience, the capacity to be alone cannot develop. Specifically, Winnicott was referring to the infant and mother relationship, and to the developmental process through which a young child learns to feel secure on his or her own and self-contained when with others, because the reliable presence of the mother conveys the sense that the environment is benign and allows for healthy attachments. This process may well still be important, but children who grew up in the decades after Winnicott published his essay have had more opportunities to cultivate an ability to be alone, and not only because so many had private bedrooms. One striking cultural change related to the rise of private bedrooms concerns the way child psychologists advise parents to help their infants sleep. For most of human history, mothers and infants slept together. Today, the great majority of the world's mothers and children still do. The biological anthropologist James McKenna, who directs the Mother-Baby Behavioral Sleep Lab at Notre Dame University, argues that in the process of evolution, mothers developed an innate capacity to attend to the needs of their sleeping children, even when they themselves are in deep sleep. While many cultures have used cradles to support sleeping babies, the crib was not widely marketed to or used by middle-class families until the 20th century. Initially, babies who slept in cribs were placed near their mothers, close to or right next to the family bed. But in late 1946, a pediatrician named Benjamin Spock published The Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care, in which, among other things, he advised parents to place newborns in rooms of their own so that they could learn to sleep independently, while also giving mom and dad some privacy and peace. It's hard to measure the impact of a few lines in an advice book, but this, of course, was no ordinary publication. The Common